When the David Fincher film Fight Club came out in 1999, it took hold right away with at least part of American culture, with young men for sure, the guys of Generation X, the middle children of history, as the Brad Pitt character Tyler Durden puts it, no purpose, no place. To keep from feeling numb in a corporate material culture, the men in the movie got together and hit each other as hard as they could. But it also inspired fight clubs in the real world. All over the country, guys were trying to recreate the sensation they had felt in the film. There was a fight club in Utah County, in Provo, started by BYU and Utah Valley University students, and it got a lot of national attention. I guess the image of young Mormon men beating the crap out of each other seemed interesting. Bianca Klein was in the fight club. These days, she's a successful cinematographer. But back then, she was a student at BYU and also a man.
Right at the time that Fight Club had come out, I was living in a house full of guys who just started boxing with each other. We'd wear gloves, and it lasted for 3 or 4 minutes. And we weren't out to hurt each other or see who can get hurt. It was more sport than destructive. And we were doing it once a week. It grew pretty exponentially. Within a few months, there were hundreds of people showing up every week to watch people fight each other. Both men and women, but mostly men. But at that time, I was very much confused. I knew that I was a woman, but I was trying to be a man because society and my religion all telling me, nope, that's not the way to live. That's not going to be good. And so I was trying to make a go at it. And I ended up in the fighting as a way of trying to prove that I was masculine to the people around me, but also to myself. You know, I saw that as like, well, if I can get in there and punch somebody else, that then that'll show that I'm a man. I only did it once because I got the hell beat out of me. I was in my living room. There was 50 people in there and they kind of formed a circle. And my adrenaline was up really high and it makes it really difficult for me to focus. But at the same time, I'm hyper aware of everything that's happening. And I was fighting this guy that was much better than me. And I mean, he just pounded on me for 3 rounds and I was mostly playing defense. You know, I'd been in fights before that, but nothing really controlled and thought out. Like, there was no anger involved with it. Or, ooh, this person might beat me to the ground and leave me to die kind of fight either. You know, it was like, okay, it's going to be 3-4 minutes. We'll see how long I can last. After I went through it, I felt kind of proud of myself, actually.
So you thought, I'm going to give this a go. I'm really a woman, but I'm born a man, mm-hmm. or however you're thinking about it, right? And one way to give this a go is you got to fight.
Well, I mean, at the time, like, there wasn't a really good path to being trans, like, other than being very secretive about it. And that meant giving up your family and giving up my career, you know, trying to be a cinematographer. And so, yeah, I decided instead of doing that, I was going to make a go of being a guy, trying to live that way, trying to just do that for the rest of my life. And part of it, yeah, was trying to be part of this fight club. It was like, okay, that's what being male is. Then I'll give it my all. And I think that some of it had come from watching Fight Club.
Sometimes all you could hear were the flat, hard, packing sounds over the yelling.
I was very aware that we had taken the wrong message from Fight Club, because to me it was, we were doing something similar to the beginning of the second act of Fight Club, where they're fighting in the basement of a bar, and it's a few guys, and they're being macho, but really like having a brotherhood camaraderie.
Who you were in Fight Club is not who you were in the rest of the world. A guy came to Fight Club for the first time, his ass was a wad of cookie dough. After a few weeks, he was carved out of wood.
And as soon as it started growing too big and becoming out of hand, I was very aware that it was becoming spectacle and it wasn't about community anymore. It was more about watching people beat on each other. It's very strange to talk about it now because I'm very anti-violence. I know that that sounds duplicitous on my behalf, like loving a film like Fight Club. But I think that Fight Club actually is more of a, it's more anti-violence than people give it credit for. I think it's the kind of film where it's like they're going to really push you as an audience member to think about what's going on and say, is this really a good idea?
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Fight Club is the latest film in our Through the Lens series. We're going to be screening it next week. But today in the program, we wanted to get you ready for it. Because ever since the film came out, there's been this ongoing debate about what it means. It's based on a novel by the writer Chuck Palahniuk. Edward Norton plays a bland, jaded office worker who can't sleep and is looking for something to make him feel something. He meets the Brad Pitt character, Tyler, who has rejected the rules of polite society. And the Fight Club they start spreads to petty acts of vandalism and pranks, all the way to an all-out terrorist organization. And the debate about the film is whether it's glorifying the violence and nihilism or satirizing it, making a statement about the potential of human nature that isn't cynical, but hopeful. We turned to Bianca Klein this week to help us talk about the film. She was joined by Hubble Palmer. He's a screenwriter and an assistant professor in the Film and Media Arts Department here at the University of Utah. It was Palmer who suggested Fight Club for the film series. And I asked him why.
Well, I thought about the theme of the series, which is movies that matter or movies that still matter. And I kind of took that as a question, like, I thought it'd be interesting to think of a film that maybe tapped into the zeitgeist in the past and ask, does it still matter? Yeah. My writing partner and I talk all the time about zeitgeist movies, you know, movies that
tapped into something.
Exactly. And that kind of led me to Fight Club.
Because you think it does.
I think it does. I think it's not only holds up, but its esteem has grown over time. Mm. It's the kind of movie where you could show it to a young person in 2022 and they might be shocked and offended by it, but it would speak to them in a way maybe even more so than it would have in 1999 when it came out.
Mm. Bianca, we'll talk about particulars as we go, but what do you think about this film? How do you think about it? Just your general kind of reaction to it.
I think that it's quite prescient. Mm. It saw a problem coming that 23 years later is still growing, that the problem of listlessness and not having a purpose in the world for both men and women is growing. And I think it's even more relevant now than it was, even though it has some dated things with technology and the way we live. But that idea is still very much there.
Do you remember your first encounters with it, Hubble?
The movie was recounted to me beat by beat by my sister and her husband.
They were excited about it.
They had just seen it and they were like, oh my gosh, you got to see this movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know if I can see this movie, because at the time I was really like careful about what kind of violent movies I watched. Now I'll watch anything. But at the time I was –
before you lost your innocence.
Exactly.
Yes, yes.
And it was amazing how they could recount every scene almost word for word. I mean, I think they spent an hour telling me about this movie and I got so excited. Just by that conversation, I felt like I had seen the entire movie.
Wow.
I saw the film with two female friends of mine, and everybody was really excited to watch it. And we went, and there was, I mean, at first it was like, oh, all these gorgeous men with their shirts off and sweaty and being manly. And it was like kind of a turn on in that way for hetero women.
Yeah.
But like, and then thinking about it and talking it with about it with female friends, it's really like a feminist film in the way it's not, you know, hoorah for women necessarily, but it's pointing out the problems, which I think is an aspect of the film that gets overlooked, that it's generally about men and not having their place in the world. But it's very – Marla embodies the modern problem of for women, of just not having as much purpose in the world.
Did you – Hubble, when you saw it, when you finally did see it, did you think it was – this is a word that Bianca's used to describe it – special?
I really did. What I liked about it was how ingenious it was. You know, one thing that I tell my students is if you can come up with 10 clever scenes, you know, 10 scenes for your script that no one has ever seen before, you're on the right track. And this movie has double that. Like there are just so many ingenious moments, you know. I mean, people talk about the surprise at the end, you know, the third act twist. But I think it's engrossing way before that.
Let's talk about in the early part of the film, the narrator. He doesn't feel anything. He's isolated and doesn't see a purpose to life. And he starts to connect for some reason and sleep and be able to sleep because he has chronic insomnia by going to these support groups, one after the other after the other.
And now I'm bankrupt. I'm divorced. My two grown kids won't even return my phone calls.
Strangers with this kind of honesty make me go a big rubbery one.
Go ahead, Cornelius. You can cry.
And then something happened. I let go. Lost in oblivion. Dark and silent and complete. I found freedom. Losing all hope was freedom.
It's okay.
What is he getting out of those support groups? What is he looking for, do you think?
I think he's getting attachment to other humans, which kind of gets cut out of modern society. Of, you know, working, he works in a cubicle, he flies around and he meets people very temporarily. And so I think he's looking for attachment to other humans, some sort of interaction. But it's really just a patch. It's a kind of a placebo of like, hey, you're having interactions with humans, but he's not really getting close with them, which leads him to some not so healthy ideas, but something that is closer to actual human interaction.
Do you think that's what it's about in some ways, at least maybe initially? I mean, it's about a lot of things, I think, and it's complicated. But is that a key point to talk about? The fact that, in this case, a man and the idea of men, young men, not feeling connected, feeling isolated, that in some ways that is a big theme here, is finding, whether it's good for you or not, some kind of community?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You know, I had a period of time where I went to a lot of support groups myself.
Huh.
I wasn't copying the movie, but I was just sort of – that was just the community that I found myself in. And there's a very real kind of healing that can happen in those situations. Now, if you go into it dishonestly like he does, you know, he has a different name for every meeting that he goes to, right? You're not going to – it's not going to have that deep soul healing effect. It's like he takes one false path and then he takes another false path. This like – he goes from the hugging to the, you know, beating each other, you know, different kinds of connection that don't really work.
What do you think?
is trying to find community.
Yeah.
Because, and I think this is why the movie is even more relevant now, that in the last 20 years with social media and an online presence, you can live your life on at home, online, and not ever really connect with people, that it's even more of a problem of not having really genuine interactions with other humans. You know, now you can live a good portion of your life with an avatar and not actually meeting people. And it's pretty bad for the human psyche. We're meant to interact with other humans.
Let's back up. We'll come back to how it's relevant today. But let's back up and talk about how it was relevant in 1999 when it came out. Where does it fit? How about you first? Where does this film fit for its time? Ed Norton has talked about how the film explores these the conflicts that we're facing, the particular sort of preeminent generation at the time, Gen X, right? It's a generation that was raised on TV, one of the first, of course. It was a generation that he said had – this is how he put it – had its value system largely dictated by advertising culture. We see Ed Norton as the narrator delighted by going through his IKEA catalog. Are you seeing that theme of consumerism? It's interesting to see that idea. I mean, it certainly starts to take hold in the 80s, this idea of the sort of society of greed, the idea of consumerism. And in some ways, you're seeing it in its earliest days, I guess, in this film, do you think?
I think it's changed since the film came out, because back then it was very much, how do we sell things to people?
Yeah.
And in the last 20 years, it's become even more of humans are commodities. Not even just how do we get them to spend money, but how do we get them engaged with our website, with our social media, and you just as an existing human being going on to different sites and liking things becomes the commodity for them. And so it's even more a part of your life, that you are more something to sell.
All right, I want to talk about a scene in the film. Whether you've seen the movie itself or not, you know this scene. And it's the scene where Tyler says, I want you to hit me as hard as you can.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me this one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. I don't know. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars. So come on. Hit me before I lose my nerve.
Oh, God. This is crazy.
So go crazy. Let her rip.
Hey, I don't know about this.
I don't either, but who gives a? No one's watching. What do you care?
Wait, what? This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
This is so stupid.
Mother! Hit me in the ear!
Well, Jesus, I'm sorry.
Ow! Christ! Why the ear, man?
I f***ed up, kind
of. Oh, that was perfect.
What do you think he means when he says to the narrator in that scene, how much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? What's going on in that scene? Take me through that.
I think he's really delving into a somatic experience, incorporating, you know, which fighting does is incorporate your body and your mind. But I think you're like fighting ends up bringing out your most base self, something I want to say in an animalistic or your lizard brain, where it's like you react and things come out of you without you thinking through them, talking through them. You know, it's like, who are you as a person really when you're put in that corner, you know, facing really intense pain and possible damage. I think right after he says that, he says, I don't want to die without any scars.
Yeah.
I used to be kind of embarrassed of the scars on my body. Mm. And now I look at them as battle wounds or something I've earned, where it's just by living a crazy life, which everyone's life I think is pretty crazy. It's like, you know, I look at people that are older and I think, wow, they're wrinkled and they're scarred and you can see on their face the things they've lived through. And I think that the film is trying to create that a bit, where it's like, yeah, the guy who's carved out of wood, who's been in these fights and done something, is a lot more impressive than the, quote, perfect bodied male, like the people they see in advertisements.
Yeah, there's that scene where they see the Calvin Klein ad.
On the bus.
Like, is that what a man looks like?
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. It's such a new version of man.
Yeah.
Like for all of history, it's been man. We're manly and strong and,
But here's the question. For people who are seeing the film and seeing that moment, and in general, what is this about? Is it about these are the questions that occurred to me? Is this about masochism? Is this about experiencing something real because they're living their lives and feeling numb, and so being hit? Or hitting makes them come alive? Is it that? Is it freedom? Is it good? Is it not so good? What do you make of those questions? Because those seem to be the questions that are raised by the whole premise of this film.
I think that the film ultimately is an unreliable narrator and an unreliable storyteller in the form of writer and director. Mm-hmm. That they're not condoning this or saying this is the answer. I think that they're saying this is what happens when we don't address this problem, which we really haven't addressed this problem. He saw it as a problem, Chuck Palahniuk and then Fincher, where it's like, well, there's a problem with men and with women that are very listless. What do we do? And I think that he believes, these men saw it that way, and which is why I think it has appealed to a lot of men in an unhealthy way. But if you watch to the end, I don't think that the filmmakers believe that. You get to the end and it all falls apart and it's horrible, and the real ending is, let's work on something else.
Yeah.
There has to be another way to do this, but it's not trying to be preachy, which most good art doesn't do.
Hmm.
It's not saying, here's the problem, I have the answer for you, do with it what you will. He's saying, here's a problem and here's really bad consequences that are going to happen if we don't take care of it.
Well, I think it's what Tyler says, or the narrator, I guess, says, that was so appealing about being in those fights, is that nothing was solved. Nothing mattered. It wasn't about winning. It wasn't about losing. It was like a Pentecostal church, and we all felt saved in some reason. There didn't have to be a solution to it. It was just experiencing life, I guess.
Mm-hmm. My opinion is that the movie does glorify violence. It makes it look awesome. And it makes it look cool. And
no one gets a concussion.
Yeah. It makes it look sexy. I mean, Brad Pitt looks amazing in the movie. It does glorify violence, but that's okay. We're allowed to have irresponsible movies,
I think that the film, from the point of view of the narrator, but also the storytelling, is very anarchistic and kind of nihilistic and wants to break down the structures in the same way that Tyler Durden does, wants to break down the structures of society to start over, that the technique of storytelling in the film is anarchistic in its own self. It's postmodernism to the max of, we're going to show you the perfs on the side of the film and the characters are going to talk to the camera and we're going to show you things that are impossible, but you're inside the head of the narrator / Tyler Durden. And I think that that mirrors what's going on. And I think that that sort of thing works the same way that the punk movement did, where it's like, we're not saying this is amazing, but it's reactionary to what else is going on in the world.
Bianca Klein, she's a cinematographer. Her films include Murder Among the Mormons and Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. Hubble Palmer also joined us. He's a screenwriter and an assistant professor in the Film and Media Arts Department at the University of Utah. We're going to be screening the film next week, next Wednesday night. That's the 5th of October. And this time, we're going to be in the auditorium at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be listener-focused and listener-supported public radio. We're grateful for our community of donors and sustainers who make monthly contributions to the station. If you rely on our programming to stay informed, become our newest sustainer with a gift of just $5 a month. Or consider an increase to your existing contribution. Get started today at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our film series, Through the Lens. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center and the film department at the University of Utah. This year, we've been screening films some people think of as classics. This month, we're talking about David Fincher's 1999 film, Fight Club. It's about men who feel disconnected from the world and who find an authentic experience by hitting each other as hard as they can. Their fight club ultimately gets way out of hand, and the question we've been talking about is whether the film is a critique of toxic masculinity or an exaltation. We have with us the cinematographer Bianca Klein and the film professor Hubble Palmer. Okay, so this part is one of the parts of the conversation that, of course, is a complete spoiler. The narrator and Tyler are the same person. How do you explain this or talk about this? How about you first? Basically, the narrator has created Tyler.
Yeah. Tyler is everything the narrator wishes he was. You know, he's great looking. He's got amazing fashion sense. He can talk to anyone. He seems to love his job, even though I don't know if I would want to sell soap, you know. And yet there's also a dark side to that, you know. Yeah. He's dangerous, violent, megalomaniacal, we find out after the midpoint, you know.
And misogynistic.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. And there's this idea of, you know, the narrator is kind of the superego.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler's the id.
Yeah.
And at the end, those two are reconciled and he sort of gets back to his true self.
Fincher said Tyler was the Nietzschean Übermensch. The narrator saw him as the ideal human. And here's the thing that's interesting about that is like Fincher talked about how Tyler is not burdened with empathy or any other larger sense of responsibility to society. So he doesn't have to worry about the moral or ethical implications for his actions. So for the narrator, Tyler is that side of him who can live with that idea, just that pure idealism, right? Philosophy. But that's not how the real world works. He's created this creature who doesn't have to worry about any of that. But in fact, in the real world, you have to make compromises. In the real world, you have to do stuff that is boring. And you are subservient to some corporate overlord sometimes. It's just the way it is. So what do you guys make of that sort of conflict, I guess, that's really playing out in this film?
I think it's the rest of the scene that you were talking about, that he says, we've all been led to believe we'd be rock stars and millionaires and movie stars. And they're slowly learning they're not going to be, that's not the life for them. And that's Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
You know? He is the rock star version of everything, but that rock star life isn't real generally and often comes with a heavy price. And that's disappointing when that's what you grow up on. You know, we grow up on this idea of you'll be a star, everyone loves you, everyone gets to be famous, and it's not true.
The scene where Tyler holds a gun to a cashier's head behind a convenience store. And it's a disturbing scene.
Raymond, you're going to die. Is that your mom and dad? Mom and dad are going to have to call up kindly Dr. So-and-so. Pick up your dental records. Want to know why? Because there's going to be nothing left of your face.
Oh, come on.
An expired community college student ID. What'd you study, Raymond?
Stuff?
Where the midterms are? I asked you what you studied.
Biology, mostly.
Why?
I don't know.
What did you want to be, Raymond K. Hessel? The question, Raymond, was what did you want to be?
Answer him, Raymond. Jesus.
Veterinarian.
Animals.
Yeah, animals.
Good stuff. Yeah, I got that. That means you have to get more schooling.
Too much school.
Would you rather be dead?
No.
Would you rather die here on your knees in the back of a convenience store?
Please, no.
I'm keeping your license. Gonna check in on you. I know where you live. If you're not on your way to becoming a veterinarian in 6 weeks, you will be dead. Now run on home.
Run, Forrest, run!
I feel ill.
Imagine how he feels.
Come on, this isn't funny. That wasn't funny. What the f*** was the point of that?
Tomorrow will be the most beautiful day of Raymond Chaos's life. His breakfast will taste better than any meal you and I have ever tasted.
What do you make of that? Because I found that a really interesting moment.
You know, there's this narrative in society that if you have a near-death experience, you appreciate life more. Mm-hmm. You know, your priorities change. So he's giving this man the gift of a near-death experience, you know.
I mean, very much agree.
I mean, what makes it clever to me as a scene is that the dream that this store clerk has isn't, I always wanted to be a rock star. It's that I wanted to be a veterinarian. Yeah. You know, it's kind of, it's almost like saying I want to be a pharmacist, you know. Mm. And one thing I was thinking about the other day was there are scenes that feel like they could be easily lifted out of the script, mm-hmm. you know, because there's nothing that necessarily leads into them and they don't, nothing after that point is depending on that story material. Mm-hmm. That scene could have been a clean lift out, you know, and yet they kept it in just because it's a really good scene. It's really riveting. I've just never seen a scene like that before.
Let's talk about David Fincher and where Fight Club fits. I guess that's the question. Where does this film Fight Club fit? Not just in the order of the work. It's early on. Mm-hmm. But what does it say about his work?
I'll just do a little history. David Fincher starts as a commercial and music video director. Yeah. You know, he's directing Madonna's Vogue, Express Yourself, Aerosmith's Janie's Got a Gun. Mm-hmm. And he's really at the pinnacle of that particular profession. You know, he's without peer at that time. He gets an opportunity to direct Alien 3.
Right.
It doesn't go so well. It's a grueling experience. So a lot of music video directors, when they actually do features, they're like, well, why am I putting myself through this? I can make a lot more money on these jobs where I'm completely in control. Mm-hmm. But his next movie is Seven, and it's a giant hit.
Yeah.
And then he does The Game, which was, underperformed, but is a wonderful film. You like The Game?
I love it.
Yeah. And then Fight Club comes along, and it's sort of the movie that crystallizes. I think he made great, interesting choices before that, but I think his style crystallizes with Fight Club. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely, for me, it's Seven or Fight Club that are his best. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's technically grown. You know, he has more skills in his palette, but I think that they both have the passion of youth, that he is that he's lived this experience, maybe not literally, but you know, he's lived that Generation X hopelessness, and that he comes from that world of advertising is amazing. You know, he kind of had a hand in creating what that consumerist ideal was.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And that then he tears it down. And it's really interesting that he convinced a studio to give him $60 million to make a movie that's basically anti them.
Yeah.
It's anti-corporation.
Yep.
It's anti-corporate America. And it's like, and he's spending tons of their money to do it.
Let's talk about the reaction at the time. There was a concern about, or a lot of angst about, whether or not it was quote unquote socially responsible as a film. Here's Roger Ebert and the way mm-hmm. he reacted to Fight Club. He said, Fight Club is the most frank and cheerfully fascist big star movie since Death Wish, a celebration of violence in which the heroes write themselves a license to drink, smoke, screw, and beat one another up. It's macho porn. That characterized some of the reaction, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for goodness sake. how many stars did he give it?
Oh, I have no idea. Okay. I'm sure
up.
Thumbs down, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
All you can say is, you know, people said the same sorts of things about Bonnie and Clyde, you know, when it came out. Like, this is irresponsible. All this violence. It's almost like they're saying it's okay to rob banks, you know. But over time, we've learned that critics are definitely living in their moment.
Yeah.
And they're trying to – I think they feel a sense of social responsibility. And this was right in the wake of the Columbine Massacre.
Yeah, had to be delayed.
Exactly.
Yeah, because of that.
And so you can hardly blame people for being alarmist about it. But, you know, I think Empire Magazine voted Tyler Durden the number one movie character of all time. I think Fight Club is in IMDb's top 10 movies of all time. You know, it just, it's a movie that connects with people. And there are lots of reasons to see it.
Outside of whether or not it's socially responsible,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, does art have to be socially responsible?
I think. I was in film school when the movie came out. And we were required to read a book called, I think it's called Hollywood versus America.
Oh, the Michael Medved book?
Yes. And it was very much, it was a book all, I'd read that right before I watched the movie. And it was all about how Hollywood's just trying to subvert and they're just intentionally trying to be shocking to try and get attention and to draw audiences in. And I had that in my mind when I went into Fight Club. And I just thought, oh, this has all the things that he was talking about, that it has the sex and the violence and trying to just tear everything down. But I still loved the film. Mm. And I think that in hindsight, after I thought about it for a long time, I realized it was because the movie and the storyteller, Fincher, were not trying to do that. They weren't trying to subvert society. They were trying to show society, there's a problem here. Let's take care of it.
I feel like that question, I sort of switch between two paradigms, you know, like as a creative person, whenever I hear about creative restrictions being put on, any kind of rules being put on filmmaking, I'm like, no, no, no.
Right.
But as a parent, you know,
yeah,
I'm so cautious about what I show my children, you know. I was watching way worse stuff at their age, you know. My daughter's 12 and I think I'd seen a lot more than she's seen at her age, you know. So,
well, it gets to – well, that leads to, I think, an important question again, and back to the idea of whether or not it's an expression and a dated expression of toxic masculinity. What do you make of that part, the kind of casual misogyny in it, and how are you sort of working that into the way you think about this film and appreciate this film? Is it one of those things that you have to sort of discount and look the other way about? Like, how are you thinking about that?
I think there is a lot of toxic masculinity there.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a lot of things in the film that you can disagree with, that I disagree with, that I think is a good – I think it's a good thing. I don't think that films should be spoon-feeding people. Here's the problem. Here's the answer. It's more of, you know, here's a crazy idea, and then you can push against it, and you become stronger in that way. And that's a very fine line between – you know, I mean, I was in my 20s when I was watching it. But what about the 13-year-old that's watching it and, you know, doesn't have a strong opinion? So it is a really – I think it is a very fine line that's not – doesn't work for everyone. I definitely wouldn't show it to my kids because I think that they're not ready for it. I think it's the kind of film where it's like they're going to really push you as an audience member to think about what's going on and say, is this really a good idea? But on the other side of the coin, there are tons of people who've taken it wrong and, you know, grown in their toxic version of the world.
Yeah.
What do you make of the end? In the end, how are we left? Does it reject nihilism in the end? Does it offer something? How to put it? It's this kind of lovely end, right? That is still incredibly tragic seeming in some ways. So what do you make of it? Does it leave people thinking a kind of hopefulness maybe about things?
I don't really know. I don't know that it's necessarily hopeful, but more of a new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's like, okay, everything you just watched for the last 2 hours was not the answer.
Yeah.
But we have the chance to change things. I mean, in the rubble of, you know, I think that a lot of the film is impressionistic, you know, that the building's coming down. They were symbols for trying to tear down this structure that's really boxing us in, you know, the corporate structure and the having credit and all of that. He's like, let's get rid of that kind of thing that's not important in the sense of, you know, humans having purpose, and let's do something else. Mm. He doesn't say what exactly that is, but leaves us, you know, in the form of Jack and Marla,
and if he did
do what he wants,
if he did say it, it would be less perfect of an ending. Right?
Oh, absolutely,
for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I guess finally, for those who haven't, look, we're just hoping people come mm-hmm. and watch it. And maybe they've seen it before and it will be cool to see it in the theater with other people. That's what's great, I think, about a movie experience. We're just mm-hmm. hoping they'll see it, whether they've seen it or not. For those who will come and haven't, how do you prepare them? You're like your students or the people that you talk to. Do they need to be prepared? I mean, one thing we should say is if you don't – and at this point it's too late. Like mm-hmm. don't – so I guess I was going to say don't because we've already spoiled a lot of it. So how do you prepare people for the experience, I guess, if you do?
I'd say come in ready to watch it with fresh eyes if you've seen it before.
Yeah.
You know, it's – I was trying to picture what the movie would feel like if you didn't know the twist ending, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still a great ride even without the twist ending. But also – you'll be surprised at how prophetic this movie is. You know, there are so many things, so many even tossed off lines that are like, oh yeah, that's totally how life is today. Like there was this moment where they talk about the space program and how in the future the space program will be sponsored by major corporations. Yeah. You know, and they don't name Amazon, Virgin, and
SpaceX,
obviously, but you know, that's exactly what has happened.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that seems right. The sense of it being even more relevant now in some ways than it was.
Oh, and then I'm sure I'm not the first person who said this, but January 6th kind of feels like an outgrowth of this toxic masculinity,
sure.
Especially the Proud Boys.
That's going to, I think, feel more relevant for people almost than the consumerism part is
totally.
That part.
Yeah. The fact that the Proud Boys kind of have this boys club, mm-hmm. fight club feel to them, mm-hmm. I think when you look back at the movie, it feels very prophetic in that way.
I would say that my photography teacher in school told me about, you know, before most people became literate, that everyone knew how to read visual cues, paintings and such, because that was the only way they could get stories. And it's ironic that now that we're in this age where we're just drowning in imagery, that we don't really know how to read the imagery. We don't know how to take those visual cues. And I think that a film like Fight Club is something that should be approached more like a book. Like we're going to deconstruct it. We're going to talk about it. It's not just a comic where you read it and then throw it away. That may offend comic readers, but it's not something that, like a Marvel movie. It's like come into it with open eyes and then discuss it. Like, was it all right? Was it all correct? We're used to the director just telling us what to think, and that's not true. The director's trying to intentionally subvert our ideas. He doesn't believe this is, you know, that Project Mayhem is the way to forward men's, you know, purpose in life. It's like, he's telling you that during the film, you know, by the way, but through Tyler Durden. But he's challenging you and saying, push against me because this is bad. And when it comes in your real life, then you know how to push it away.
That's Bianca Klein. She's a cinematographer. Her latest film is the terrific Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. And Hubble Palmer was also with us. He's a screenwriter and assistant professor in the Film and Media Arts Department at the University of Utah. We're going to be screening the film Fight Club next week. That's next Wednesday night. And take note here, this time we're going to be in the auditorium at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll get started at 7. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Andrew Christiansen is our intern. The program is produced by Kerry Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.